Asymmetrical Haircuts, Justice Update, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg, in partnership with justiceinfo.net.
We can see already from the communities that the level of excitement is palpable, as well as the expectations.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, Janet.
Yes, today we're talking about the extraordinary reparations award that the International Criminal Court has made in the case against Dominic Ongwen that was at the end of February this year. Speaking there was Sarah Kasande. She's the representative of the International Centre for Transitional Justice, and she's based in Kampala. And we'll hear a lot more from her later on, and also Pamela Angwech, who's a women's activist. But first, let's have Stephopedia. What do we need to know about the Ongwen case and the context?
So we are talking about Dominic Ongwen. He is a former child soldier turned LRA commander. He was part of the war in northern Uganda, which was basically the government forces against the Lord's Resistance Army run by Joseph Kony. And UN says about 100,000 people were killed and many, many more affected. Ongwen was transferred to the ICC in January 2015. He was eventually convicted for 61 counts related to the attacks on four internally displaced camps known as Abok, Lukodi, Kajule, and Odek, as well as thematic crimes of sexual violence and the conscription of child soldiers. The initial investigation was quite narrow, but it was later broadened and also took in crimes that he was supposed to have committed as the commander of the senior brigade.
So let's go in a bit more depth into the reparations decision. Here's the basic summary from Sarah.
It was noteworthy for me that the court acknowledged the various dimensions of harms. The physical harm that most of the victims of this crime suffered, whether it is abduction, torture, killings, but also the moral harm. And one of the key aspects of this process is in the reparations submissions of the Trust Fund for Victims, Common Legal Representatives, but also the amicus. Extensive emphasis was laid on the moral harm that resulted from these crimes. And by moral harm, we're looking at what resulted after a person suffered this crime, the loss of education opportunities, the loss of an ability to achieve their potential, the loss of a family structure, those various dimensions that have a social element to them. So court recognizes that.
Okay, Steph, again, before we go any further, Stephopedia away, what was the actual award?
The actual award, when it comes down to money, which is usually the Reuters headline, is that judges estimate that they would need about 52 million euros to pay for everything they have granted. And that includes symbolic individual payment of 750 euros per victim and additional collective reparations like rehabilitation programs, memorial sites, those kind of things. And then the judges have also done a kind of rough back of the envelope calculation that they think there would be upwards of 50,000 victims that would be eligible for these things. And they also said that the symbolic reparation was the most important and the Trust Fund for Victims should get that out first before they start doing collective reparation things.
Okay, we'll go into some more of the detail from and the perspectives from on the ground. But Sarah told me when I was chatting to her that really there were lots of important things in this decision, and she wanted to focus to start with on what the judges said about moral harm, that this was on all kinds of levels, including the psychological harm that many of the victims continued to endure, in fact, maybe most of the victims, and importantly, the transgenerational victims.
One of the key effects is we have many children who are born as a result of sexual violence, who live with stigma, but also community and social rejection. This has impacted their ability to reintegrate, but also has lasting psychological impact. But also related to that, families of those who were killed or abducted also endure this psychological harm. So recognizing this layer of transgenerational harm, not just for the victims, but also for their families and their children, was also key.
So those harms that she talks about are really broad, But there's also other broader harms, including ones related to the loss of property and the loss of infrastructure that have affected the whole community.
The multiple dimensions of harm that the court recognized to me were broad enough, taking into account what the communities suffer. I mean, the loss of property could also fall under material harm, but also there are dimensions of it within moral harm. So to me, I welcome the court's broader view of the types of harms that communities suffered beyond just the physical, psychological, and material, but taking into account the broader socioeconomic.
So let's just rewind the clock a moment and think back to how the judges actually made their mind up on this reparations decision. How did they get there?
Well, in 2022, the court issued an order inviting amicus curiae submissions from basically across the board and different actors, several of them actually from Uganda and some experts from other countries, to say what kind of harms they would have to alleviate. And it was really telling that the judges made some very sweeping and broad statements about this intergenerational harm and the things that those experts have said. You could really, I normally assume that the judges read all the submissions, but they really, really did here. And it was very clear that they had really thought about the continuing, ongoing impact on all kinds of different ways of this kind of conflict. I thought that was very, very broad when they explained it.
And also, as Sarah says, it was a lot of local input.
The Masai was among the first where you have so many local organizations who applied and were successfully admitted.
Sarah specifically mentioned to me the Religious Peace Initiative and the Uganda Victims Foundation, which worked together with her organization, ICTJ, and the Uganda Association of Women's Lawyers. So I asked her, who are all of these organizations?
Organizations that had been working for decades almost, with victims, with communities, witnessing firsthand how the crimes continue to impact the victims, but their broader communities, the harms that they'd suffered. So that they were really uniquely placed to offer suggestions in terms of what types of harms, but also the modalities of reparations.
Let's just introduce Pamela now. She's the Executive Director for Women, Economic Development and Globalization, an activist in supporting and promoting the rights of women, especially war victims. And a little bit of a contrast with Sarah, she said that there was actually a range of reaction that she got from different people, both positive and some negative views. And to start with, this was because so many people in the community really weren't sure what was going to happen, when it was going to happen. This prosecution of Dominic Ongwen took forever to take place, so loads of uncertainty. And these are communities who've experienced extensive trauma and probably extensive promises that never seem to deliver anything to them. The generational harm, as we've mentioned, people who were abducted by LRA rebel forces and then gone back into the community, and that's something that has to be managed. And Pamela said that people were also wondering whether they'd hear anything in this about the bigger context that they also feel, which is that there they were in northern Uganda being attacked by rebels, and what did the government do? And would the government actually acknowledge in any form its role?
People are also asking question, why can't certain issues around forgiveness, just telling people, like especially for government, to ask for forgiveness and say, I think that we owe you protection during the war and we did not do our best, so you were abducted. And I think we are to a certain extent responsible. These are a mixed opinion that is coming out of the community.
So there's a lot to unpack there. Because this is complicated, it's both political and multi-generational and full of trauma and thousands of victims. It isn't just these IDP camps that Ongwen was charged with or the sexual and gender-based crime victims that he was also found guilty of. Essentially, that grouping represents just a fraction of all. And as Sarah pointed out to me, this 61 counts against him is the highest number. Is that right, Steph?
Yes, it was the highest number ever in indictments. I would have to count how many there were against the CONI for the confirmation of charges document. But I think for the moment, Ongwen stands as the largest number of counts convicted for.
So we have this very broad range of crimes in a narrow area, and we only have 4,000 or so registered victims. Those were the people who participated. In fact, the selection of those 4,000, according to Sarah, really wasn't very well handled.
Participation to me is a problematic because considering how the applications were handled, I recall at the time the registry started this process, they were given 3 months to conduct outreach and to carry out the application process. And, you know, to apply, you need to provide necessary identification and information. But also the staffing that the court had in the country at the time was limited, and they had to rely on students of Gulu University to support victims to fill in these application forms. So given this large number of victims, 3 months was a very unrealistic time frame. So it ended up leaving out quite a number, because remember, the application process had to start from a point of inform the victims, let the victims understand the process, let them collect the necessary information documentation, submit their applications. In 3 months, that couldn't happen. So many were left out.
Yeah, and those 4,000 victims or over 4,000 victims that were registered victims, it was very obvious in the ruling on the reparation that that wasn't what the judges thought were the actual victims. So they looked at mapping by the Trust Fund for Victims, and they said there are almost 50,000 victims probably. And even that is just a fraction of the overall victims who suffered from LRA crimes. And I've also heard from our correspondents in Uganda that there are massive amounts of victims of the LRA who are not linked to Ongwen, who wouldn't be eligible for reparations in this case, and who are also wondering why him and not me.
So taking that into account, the court had to look at a pragmatic approach. How do you offer reparations to this huge number of victims? Many preferred individual reparations, particularly individual monetary payments. And it is understandable because money is seen as a gateway to undertaking various initiatives that would help people improve their lives. But the court, recognizing that it would be logistically almost impossible because individual reparations would require assessment of individual harm and then determine what would be appropriate, but then setting up all these administrative processes to verify. Considering that this case, that's why I started with mentioning the period 15 years or beyond 15 years, considering that time lag, if you're to go through that, it would take another several years, not less than 5 years, to carry out this for each of the 50,000 victims.
So you can imagine the judges absorbing all of this different information and absorbing all of this different sets of advice that they had on it. And essentially, they came up with what I have heard described as a very pragmatic approach. So it's not completely individualized. It's not completely collective. There's an individualized component, but it's a community approach. And Sarah used the term, I don't know whether it's official or not, collective reparations.
What really struck me is the monetary award of 750 euros. Notwithstanding how the court describes it as a symbolic reparations measure, for the victims, this was a notable position of the court. This was really welcomed. And from what I gather, during the screening of this, when people had this, because the screening was done in Acholi, there were celebrations. 750 translates to 3 million Uganda shillings. And for a victim, this would give an opportunity to start a livelihood program and pay school fees. So it is, by standards, not much, but really a considerable amount for victims who've not had anything done for them, received anything.
So I thought it was really fascinating to see how this huge case at the ICC, The Hague, is so far away from northern Uganda and so far away from conditions on the ground. But apparently, the judges were really alive. I mean, that was the phrase that Sarah used to me, to the social conditions, the socio-cultural economic conditions in the context, and especially the courts, by making this kind of an order, said, we acknowledge the suffering of all the victims in northern Uganda.
The rehabilitation measures that the court has ordered, the community rehabilitation measures, whether it is education programs, rehabilitation of health facilities or vocational training, these will have a broader spillover effect for communities and individuals in the communities where these victims live. So it will not only benefit the Ongwen victims, it will not only benefit the victims of these Ongwen's crimes, but eventually it will benefit the broader community.
Yes, they referred to all of the victims in northern Uganda and explained the way the court works, that it can only offer reparations for those of the crimes that Ongwen was found guilty of. It showed that they had a vision for more beyond the court. One of the other elements to consider is that in Uganda, there is a government reparation process that is not getting underway, and you have an actual other trial, a kind of twin to the Ongwen case. There is a trial going on in Gulu right now for Thomas Kwayelo, who is also an LRA commander. He's the first LRA commander to be tried in Uganda. Like Ongwen, he is a former child soldier. We thought Ongwen took a long time and it was so, so slow, but Kwayelo has that beat by a mile. He has been in detention since 2009 and they have only just started the defense case, as we understand. We complain about the ICC being slow, but this is another level of slowness.
Yeah, naturally, you have a different set of victims in that snail's pace case. And apparently, they were also wondering, so do those guys, quote unquote, belonging to Ongwen, get something? And we, quote unquote, belonging to Kwayelo, don't get anything? What kind of compensation are we going to get for the losses that we've experienced? Sarah and Pamela both explained the way that that dynamic is working on the ground in Uganda.
And to me, this is important because it addresses our key worry that there were going to be tensions. And these tensions had been playing out during the trial because Ongwen victims, the 4,000, were seen as preferential victims. That they're getting all the support, all the attention, the necessary care, while all the other victims were not given the same treatment, especially those in the Kwayelo trial.
It's very difficult for everybody to understand this dilemma about Dominic being prosecuted for specific crimes he has committed vis-a-vis the crimes of the LRA general. And so that is where the biggest problem is right now in the region, is there's so much mix of opinion because you know that all these prosecutions was moving in different directions.
The Kwayelo trial continues to be a stain. To me, I consider it a travesty of justice. No trial should take this long. Nevertheless, we see now it's moving forward with now the defense beginning its part, presenting its witnesses. Nevertheless, it's taken long. And in terms of whether we'll see justice, that only time will tell.
Yeah, I mean, really, the contrast there between the two processes you've laid out, Steph, but also Sarah and Pamela have noted, that must be so stark for the survivors in northern Uganda. So let's move on to a really important question, practical question. What about the money? Ongwen himself was found to be indigent and therefore he can't contribute to the award.
It is a big elephant in the room. Where's the trust fund for victims going to get these resources? We know that it is one of the most underfunded units of the court, if we may say, that barely has resources. It has to rely on fundraising and donations to fulfill its mandate. It already has existing reparations award in the Katanga reparations. But then now you add the Ntaganda as well. Now you add this one of 52,429,000 euros. Which is a huge, huge sum by the Trust Fund for Victim Standards. So as the court noted that now the onus is really upon the Trust Fund to fundraise and member states to contribute.
So, Steph, how much does the Trust Fund for Victims now have to raise? Sarah mentioned Ntaganda and maybe Katanga also before. So give us a picture. Where are we?
Well, it's a lot, a lot, a lot. Ntaganda was the previous record. There they ordered reparations of 27 million euros. Now we have Ongwen with 52 million euros, and that is on top of the other reparations, but those were slightly smaller, a couple of million, so not as much.
And let's just remind ourselves, Ntaganda, Katanga, those are both things that happened in the Democratic Republic of Congo, so not to do with Uganda itself.
The other reparations they have is three former Democratic Republic of Congo militia leaders who were convicted, and one Islamist rebel in Mali. Those all got reparations. So those are all on the reparation stage.
But have you actually looked and seen what the Trust Fund for Victims has in the kitty? I mean, I see loads of social media. I know they've got a new communications person on board now, and they're just, their social media is going great guns. They're having constant meetings and there's stuff coming in from governments. I mean, do you have a calculation?
Well, I looked at what they submitted for the budget in their year reports before Ongwen came out. And the back of the envelope calculation that I didn't put in my story because I wasn't quite sure about it. But basically, by my calculation, they had around 16 million euros in total funds, 1/6. And so that includes everything. The Trust Fund for Victims is separated in two kind of programs. They have one general assistance program for kind of victims communities whose trials are not yet being dealt with, who are not yet in the reparation stage. And then they have the actual reparation stage. So of that 16 million, I could kind of quickly make up that they had, most of that is pledged to other cases and the General Assistance Fund, but also just for other reparations. So I have no idea where they would get this amount of money, and they probably have to fundraise very specifically for it, because that's what they said they would do after Ntaganda. They said it was clear that they can't just put 27 million euros on the table, but they would fundraise specifically to kind of get those reparations.
Wow, it's a tough climate though, isn't it? If you imagine where all the demands on the states at the moment, then I'm wondering how the Trust Fund for Victims is going to be able to do that.
Yeah, but it's also weird that the court, everybody's touting it's a court for victims and we have this wonderful fund and then we just don't put any money on it because states contribute voluntarily to it. And I think the average contribution, what they've so far managed to get, if you look back over the years, is about 1 million euros per year they get in contribution. So by no means will it be enough to cover what the judges have decided. But of course, it's very difficult for victims to separate between, they said we should get X amount, and this is what's actually coming.
So just to give a quick preview, next month we should have an interview, we hope, with the new executive director of the Trust Fund for Victims. So hopefully we'll be able to put some of the questions to her. But as Sarah says, in fact, the Trust Fund for Victims is going to have to manage expectations. Also, though, the registry of the ICC, Public Affairs and Communications Unit, going to have to really ramp up to make sure the communities understand that this is a process and it is going to take time to mobilise the resources and to see that this reparations award is actually implemented.
This sum represents, even in a symbolic manner, the liability of the harm caused to victims. That to me is an important step of acknowledging that these victims suffered harm and this is the worth of the harm that they suffered. And to have that on official record in a judgment, that's an important step of acknowledgement. And for victims, that has always been the thing, they say. We want recognition for what we went through, what we suffered. So to me, that in itself is a key step forward, notwithstanding the practicality of how this money will be raised, but the fact that there's been a monetary award attached to what they have gone through. The reparations order speaks to that. Now, in terms of raising resources, we know it will be a Herculean task, but really this court was set up as a victim's court, right? Says the ICC is a victim's court. The inclusion of reparations was to recognize that it just does not deliver retributive justice, but also reparative justice. I believe that it is time now for ICC member states to live up to this promise.
Okay, change tack. You've already mentioned him. The LRA leader, Joseph Kony, or Joseph Kone, depending on how northern Uganda you want to be, has a pre-trial process planned in October. I mean, what, Steph? What is going on?
Well, the ICC is different from other courts in that you don't have an indictment from the prosecutor before. You have what's called a document containing the charges, the DCC, and that has to be confirmed by judges, usually when a suspect arrives.
But you have to physically have a suspect. I mean, is Kony going to fly in for this?
No, they're trying to alert him that this is happening. But apparently they found, well, they didn't find a loophole, but they asked judges if they could hold a confirmation of charges hearing, as it's called, in absentia, because that would really cement the charges against him and it would show the criminality. And I think Khan called it a meaningful milestone for victims, as they would get kind of some confirmation of what was done to them. And the judges said, yes, if you try really, really hard to tell him that this is going on.
Okay, mass leafleting of the Central African Republic.
And I see that the ICC outreach unit is talking on radios in northern Uganda and basically saying that this is happening. So they have to show that they made some effort, but that is probably enough.
Okay, so what's he actually charged with?
So he is facing, and I looked this up in the meantime because I said I didn't know how many charges were against Kony.
We're creating the podcast as we go.
It's held together by sellotape and crazy glue. 36 charges. Essentially, prosecutors say Kony had ultimate power over the entire LRA and he led a coordinated campaign to abduct children and integrate them into the LRA militia. Once they were in there, children were subjected to, quote, a carefully designed and coordinated regime of physical and psychological violence, end quote. And this has some horrific examples. They were forced to beat each other and even kill other abductees and other horrific details that I won't share with you in the document containing the charges, which you don't need to know. But suffice to say, it's some of the worst charges I've read.
Goodness. Okay. But I'm just thinking back to other pre-trial hearings that I have seen. And yeah, you do get some of the detail like that. But there's always a defense. I mean, is there going to be a defense lawyer?
I assume so. We don't have a name yet. The ICC has these kind of duty defense counsel. And I assume that somebody will be appointed from there unless somebody volunteers or Kony appoints somebody. I don't think that's possible. I don't think he will, but you never know. And that might be accepted. I mean, we had at the MH17 trial in the Netherlands, we had a defendant who didn't show up, but did send a lawyer and an instructor lawyer. On the other hand, I don't think Kony's been heard of or seen for many, many years. So I doubt that he will pop up to instructor lawyer at the ICC, but you never know.
Okay, there's obviously a lot of known and unknown things here. Anything else that helps us elucidate this stuff?
I had an interview with Madame Khan, the deputy prosecutor of the ICC.
No relation to Karim Khan, the prosecutor.
And she explained that part of the reason to have these hearings is also to cement the jurisprudence and to get the definition of certain crimes and to have judges kind of look at the way they want to prosecute certain things. So it's not only a way to provide something for victims, she said, but it's also a way of getting some jurisprudence on the books and getting judges to decide on certain charges, certain things that haven't been charged before. What you would usually have in a trial, now they hope they would also get part of that in that. So it's not only just for the victims, but it's also for them to legally nail down some points that they want judges to look at.
Sounds fascinating, and I'm sure you and I will spend some time reporting on it, but just imagine how it feels in northern Uganda. Pamela said that this very new and different approach, I mean, a pre-trial process that they hadn't been used to before, is also causing a lot of confusion within the communities, because you add that to people's uncertainty as to what would actually come out of Ongwen and what that really is going to mean and what has been going on in the Kwaelo trial and when that's ever going to finish. So uncertainty on top of uncertainty.
Yeah, the main question is about how can we access justice and also access reparation, because it's so clear that the incidences are linked to other crimes, which is not Dominic Ongwen and is not Kwo Yelu. Then who is responsible? Definitely everybody is looking at Joseph Kony, and that is triggering conversation because the bigger community right now are the one that is outside Dominic Ongwen in terms of the reparation support. And so there's a lot of question right now from the group, because we have some question where people said, is this the last reparation happening, or should we expect another conviction which is coming out of a different proceeding that is going to allow the broader community that suffered from the war reparated? Remember, the number of people that are really outside these reparation decisions are completely seem to be within Joseph Kony mandates of crime. And so people are asking question, how do we move forward from this? Does it require a new prosecution now that he's absent? Does it make sense? How is he going to be followed up? Where is he now? And what is he saying? Is he responsible for other crimes, or is he silent about it? So that is also giving us another level of dilemma.
Oh, wow. Well, I think we have covered an enormous amount there. And it's a really big journey to try and understand all of this and to try and process it. And it's a really interesting end, I suppose it is, to a very important and, yeah, big significant trial at the ICC. Any final thoughts from you, Steph, on this?
It shows also a bit the problem with the ICC. We had to go through this mammoth journey. We don't understand some of what is happening. And this is our bread and butter. This is what we do. We follow all these cases, following them quite closely. And even for us, it's hard to understand. So imagine victims' communities in northern Uganda trying to wrap their heads around all these different things and all these different ways. And in the end, I think for them, I mean, the judicial process matters. And I think some confirmation of what was done to you matters. But a lot of it is really, they're looking for some kind of support, tangible, substantial support, probably money or things that you can do. And that is just takes so long and is so complicated that I understand that they are looking at this court thinking, what the heck are you doing?
Well, let's just wrap up ourselves, say goodbye, and we'll leave the very last word to Sarah.
Bye.
Bye.
As a person who's been working in this field for a while, many times I've been disillusioned, I must say. It's been a long journey. So when that decision was issued and to see that, I was very moved. To me, I say, finally, you can go back to the communities and say, there is something here now. There's progress. It doesn't matter how long it will take, as long as there's a court award. It is an award that will have to be fulfilled one way or another. So it is there. So the onus is on the trust fund and the court and various stakeholders to see that this just doesn't remain on paper. But for us who have worked with victims, we can now go back and say, this is what the court has said. Now we can begin a journey of repair.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net, an independent site covering justice effort for mass violence. Music is by audionautics.com, and you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.
If you'd like to support this podcast, please check out our support us page at asymmetricalhaircuts.com.
Yes, do buy us a coffee on Patreon. That way you also get to hear our special War Criminals Book Club recordings with our fellow international justice reporter, Molly Quell.
He steadfastly insisted that he was guilty, quote, only of aiding and abetting in the commission of the crimes with which he was charged, that he himself had never committed an overt act. And like, I think I could have written that sentence basically for every single defense of a suspect I have ever covered in any trial in any court for like war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity.
It's often a bit of a riot.
And sometimes it's a serious discussion about books and sometimes not, and sometimes films. And we'll pick things that portray the worlds of international courts and war crimes.
And it's only on Patreon.
Come find us there.